I didn't know which motherfuckers and what kind of tripping, but I've known Charlie long enough to know it wasn't good. News of the incident was building on set, and a crowd was forming around the bathrooms. By the time we reached the scene, there's 10 of us. To the left are 15 Mozambican PAs, and to the right, 30 white South African crew members. Charlie walks right into the middle.
"Who did it?" he says.
The Mozambicans point to the accused crew member. We all turn to face him.
"Yo, you put somebody head in the toilet?"
Charlie says, towering over the guy. "This doesn't have anything to do with you," the man says.
"Oh, he got everything to do with me. I want my head in the toilet,"
Charlie said, now invading the man's personal space. Feeling uncomfortable with the proximity, the man takes 2 steps backward, which prompts Charlie to take 3 steps forward. Now we are fully squared off with the South African crew members, each of us picking who we gonna stretch if it kicks off.
"What I gotta do to get my head in the toilet?"
Other crew members attempt to de-escalate the situation. "Let's all just turn it down a little bit," which only prompts Charlie to turn it up.
"I want my head in the toilet. What do I have to do to get my head in the toilet? Your mother's a motherfucking bitch. Would I do it?"
Charlie says, screaming directly into the face of the accused.
"Your mother's a whole-ass fucking bitch. Would I get my head in the toilet? You like putting motherfuckers' heads in the toilet? Put my head in the toilet. Just tell me what I gotta do. If I knock your fucking front teeth out, would I get my head in the toilet?"
Just then, Michael Mann walks up. He had heard of the incident brewing. He was probably the only person in all of Mozambique, except probably Nelson Mandela, who could have gotten water on this fire. Michael pointed to me and then to the head of the South African crew. "You and you in my office, please. Everybody else, go back to work." "That guy needs to go home right now," I said. "It doesn't work like that," the appointed crew spokesperson said. "And with all due respect, this doesn't have anything to do with you. We will handle it internally."
"Well, you can handle it wherever you want to handle it," I said, "but you gonna handle it with your racist friend gone. He's fired. He cannot be here."
"I agree with that," Michael said. "That kind of behavior will not be tolerated on my set." "You arrogant Americans and your foolish racism," he said. "Every confrontation doesn't fit into your childish conception of race."
"So, wait a minute," I said. "Let me understand.
You're saying that he would have done the same thing had it been a white crew member." "I'm saying that you couldn't possibly comprehend the complexity of what's going on here."
"Okay," I said. "Well, how about this? The motherfucker's fired just for being a dickhead."
"Well," the man said, "if he goes, we all go." The "all" he was speaking of was about 100 members of our South African crew. If they were to leave, that would shut our film down. Tens of millions of dollars down the drain. This was a potentially catastrophic threat. My heart pounded. My mind raced. I had promised Muhammad Ali that I would bring his story to the world. If I let the crew quit, the project could be doomed. And then it hit me like a left hook from heaven. This is Ali. This moment is the whole point. Muhammad Ali gave up everything for this very purpose. Fuck this movie. Ali would never want his film to come to the screen on the back of a 17-year-old boy's head in a toilet. I was crystal clear. "Then all you motherfuckers can go to fuck home," I said. "I will spend every dime of my fee to fly a crew from the U.S. But what we're not going to do is have people's heads getting shoved into toilets on Muhammad Ali's movie. Go home." With that, I left Michael's office. Michael was 100% behind me. Ultimately, only about 20% of the crew left. Michael and I ended up splitting the overages. It was a few million dollars between us, but it felt like a no-brainer. I was coming into an understanding of the power of purpose. Purpose and desire can seem similar, but they are very different, sometimes even opposing forces. Desire is personal, narrow, and pointed, and tends toward self-preservation, self-gratification, and short-term gains and pleasures. Purpose is wider, broader, a longer-term vision encompassing the benefit of others, something outside of yourself you're willing to fight for. There have been many times in my life where I was acting from a place of desire, but I'd fully convinced myself that it was purpose. Desire is what you want. Purpose is the flowering of what you are. Desire tends to weaken over time, whereas purpose strengthens the more you lean into it. Desire can be depleting because it's insatiable. Purpose is empowering. It's a stronger engine. Purpose has a way of contextualizing life's unavoidable sufferings and making them meaningful and worthwhile. As Viktor Frankl wrote, in some ways, suffering ceases to be suffering at the moment it finds a meaning, such as the meaning of a sacrifice. A noble aim engenders positive feelings. When we pursue what we believe to be a profound and valuable goal, it stirs the best parts of ourselves and others. I am not a man who is prone to regrets, but every year for the rest of his life, Nelson Mandela sent me a message urging me to come spend some time with him. I am an old man. Do not delay. But some deep part of me felt unworthy. The world needs Nelson Mandela. Who was I to take up one more second of that man's time? I'd seen Madiba many times over the years, a charity event here and awards presentation there, only 5 and 10 minutes at a time. On December 5th, 2013, I was on a promotional tour in Sydney, Australia. I was watching TV when the current South African president, Jacob Zuma, appeared on the screen. Fellow South Africans, Zuma said, our beloved Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, the founding president of our democratic nation, has departed. Nelson Mandela died in Johannesburg, South Africa, just before 9 p.m. local time. He had been surrounded by his family and closest friends. He was 95 years old. Madiba was gone. This was one of the greatest moments of regret in my entire life. How could I not have taken him up on his offer? Over the years, I've done deep soul searching around that question. He held me in the purest affection and highest regard. It was scary to me. He saw something in me I hadn't yet seen in myself. I think subconsciously I didn't want to spend extended time with him for fear that I wouldn't live up to his impression of me. Maybe I thought he'd ask me to do something or change something about my life that I'd be unable or unwilling to change. Madiba thought I was special. I didn't want to prove him wrong. He has since appeared to me multiple times in dreams, always wearing that same knowing smile. His energy seems to communicate, I'm still here whenever you're ready. Chapter 17, Perfection. 2002, Men in Black 2 opened at number 1, $190 million domestic, $441 million global. 2003, Bad Boys 2 opened at number 1, $138 million domestic, $273 million global. 2004, iRobot
opened at number one, 144 million domestic, 348 million global. 2004 also, Shark Tale opened at number one, 161 million domestic, 371 million global. 2005, Hitch opened at number one, 177 million domestic, 366 million global. 2006, The Pursuit of Happiness opened at number one, 162 million domestic, 307 million global. 2007, I Am Legend opened at number one, 256 million domestic, 585 million global. 2008, Hancock opened at number one, 227 million domestic, 624 million global. I was going to put the totals, but I thought it might be fun for y'all to add it up with the kids. What you just heard is arguably the greatest individual hot streak in the history of Hollywood. Note, my editor forced me against my will to add arguably. I was running my life like a fight camp. Daryl became not only my trainer, but my mentor and my protector. Ali had been my first Academy Award nomination and validation of the fight camp way of life. Smith Family Trivia. The Ali nomination would be yet another award ceremony that I would miss. Willow was 1 year old and was at home with Gammy and had to be rushed to the hospital with a 103-degree fever. She had an ear infection. Jada and I sprinted from the Oscars 6 minutes before the announcement of Best Actor. As we drove away, I saw Denzel win my award on the Jumbotron. For the next 10 years, Daryl never left my side. He pushed me, motivated me, and defended my psychological space for the whole of my cinematic heyday. And he would check anybody. During this run, my team was on fire. Nobody moved how we moved. People in Hollywood were trying to figure out how we managed to be so productive and so successful so consistently. My core group, Harry, JL, Charlie, Omar, Daryl, my chief of staff, Jana Babatunde Bay, my nephews, Kyle and Dion, my brother-in-law, Caleb Pinkett, family manager, Miguel Melendez, my executive assistant, Danielle Demarella, everybody embraced the philosophy of the fight camp. We were building our lives. We were striving for perfection. We demanded excellence from each other and everybody around us. And like the junior black mafia, you could either get down or lay down. From corporate relationships to extended family and friends, Mia Pitts, property manager, Fawn Bordley, creative director, Judy Murdoch, makeup artist, Pierce Austin, hairstylist, Robert Mata, wardrobe, and all the way to the guys who detailed the cars. Everyone had to strive and climb or they could not be here. I'm a dreamer and a builder. I picture grand visions and then I build systems to make them real in the world. That is my love language. I want to help the people I love build extraordinary lives for themselves. But it demands that we be willing to grind and sacrifice, and most importantly, they have to trust me. And if they don't, it registers as a complete rejection of my love. The team started referring to themselves as the lifers. They were ride or die. It is impossible to build something that is of a higher quality than the quality of the people around you. There's a strange and perturbing success paradox. When you have nothing, you suffer the fear and pain of grinding to achieve your goals. But when you have everything, you suffer the brutal recurring nightmare of losing it all. I had the wife, I had the family, I had the property with a name. I was the biggest movie star in the world. But I started to notice the subtle sickness, a sort of sneaky poverty mentality. I was more anxious and fearful than ever. It all seems so fragile. One injury, one scandal, or one flop movie away from having to move back to Philly. What if the financial crash of 1929 happened again? There's only one fear worse than the fear of not attaining the object of your desire, and that's the fear of losing it. Opening weekends are the worst of all, pure hell. It's like a presidential election night. Everybody's scrambling around trying to cross-reference the 6 p.m. numbers out of Miami with the 7:45 numbers out of Pittsburgh. The East Coast numbers come in first. Then you hold your breath for Chicago, then Houston. And no matter how good the polls looked or how confident you are, deep down inside, you know anything can happen. A snowstorm in the Midwest on a Thursday night shuts down hundreds of theaters, killing 12% of your opening weekend box office. And depending on the genre, Siskel and Ebert trash your movie, another 6% gone. The axiom used to be, opening weekend is about the movie star. Final gross is about the movie. So while there are plenty of other factors involved and many people are going to get fired if the movie doesn't open, the face on the poster takes the biggest hit. It doesn't matter how big your previous movie was. If this one doesn't open bigger, that means you're over. That means moving trucks outside Her Lake and all the incoming boxes are labeled Robert Downey Jr. When I was 9 years old, Daddy-O took me on a job with him into the basement of 48th and Brown Shopping Bag Supermarket. I'm sure most of you have never been in the basement of a supermarket. I'm not sure I can quite communicate what it's like down there, but let me give it a shot. Imagine an old, creaky wooden staircase. One or two steps are always missing. Daddy-O points them out, but to my young mind, these bottomless gaps are not just a tripping hazard, they're gateways to hell. The stairs lead down to a very poorly lit dungeon where out-of-date food goes to die. I'm in charge of the flashlight. We need it because the string of single light bulbs is erratic and flickering ominously. This is the stuff that horror movies are made of. And both Daddy-O and I are black, so one of us is definitely not coming out alive. Our shoes squeak and squelch as every step sticks to the gunk-caked floor. Decades of broken bottles of ketchup, leaking canned goods, rotted bags of long-since-thawed peas, a repository for the unsaleable. These cellars are generally poorly ventilated and oppressively hot. The smell gets into your clothes and your hair. But Daddy-O likes it. To him, that's the aroma of hard work. That's how you fucking smell when you're doing what has to be done to feed your family. Two lines of compressors, the engines that power the refrigerator and freezer cases upstairs, run down either side of this basement abyss. I point the flashlight to the barely visible dust-covered numbers above the compressors. There it is, number 19, Daddy-O says. There are decon trays everywhere. Decon is a powerful rat poison. Rodents eat it, and it essentially burns away the interior of their stomachs and intestinal tracts, leaving a pretty disgusting disemboweled carcass. And directly under compressor 19 was the top half of a rat that had clearly overindulged on decon. Without a single moment of hesitation, Daddy-O bent down, grabbed the dead rat with his bare hand, and tossed it aside. Two slaps of his hand on the side of his jeans, presumably to fully disinfect it. Then he lay down, placing his head into the exact spot where the half a rat had spent the last month of its life. choking my lunch back down, I distinctly remember understanding that this act was for me, for my brother and sisters, for my family. But I also distinctly remember thinking that if the roles were reversed, my kids would not have eaten that night. I believe that the stress and uncertainty of Daddy-O's lifelong financial struggle was a major part of what kept him from being able to emotionally sustain a family. After you've just discarded a dead rat with your bare hand and laid your head down in the same space, you're not trying to hear shit from nobody about how hard their day was. Witnessing my parents' struggles branded me with the impression that financial stability was an imperative for love and family to have any chance whatsoever to thrive. I was on a tear, the biggest winning streak in Hollywood history. I was working 70 to 80 hours a week. Holidays, weekends, even vacations became a time to advance. I noticed that most people came back from Christmas vacation heavier and out of shape. So the holidays for me became an opportunity to extend my lead. I made it a point to come back every new year in better shape than I left the last. I would work out and sometimes even abstain from Christmas dinner as an act of personal discipline. Daryl loved and praised my austerity. "If you ain't eating, then I ain't eating," he'd say. I would spend the day studying and writing, reading a book or rewriting a script, touching in and out of whatever holiday festivities others were enjoying. I decided to throw lavish Christmas and New Year's parties. It was a win-win-win. Jada and the kids would have all of their friends and cousins and family in town for a week of mountain fun. I would lure my business associates to beautiful ski destinations that I paid for. That meant they had an all-expenses-paid trip for themselves and their families. And I got to have my whole team in a remote location, a captive audience, for daily strategy meetings that helped me get a jump on the new year and on my competition. I was killing it. I was winning at everything. And winning to me meant everything else in my life should be perfect and everyone around me should be happy. But it wasn't. And they weren't. Throughout our relationship, mornings had been Jada and my bonding, building, and connecting time. We would wake up before sunrise and talk for hours. We would share the dreams we'd had during the night, revelations, new ideas. We'd discuss the kids and any issues in our family. But these days, I could tell something was shifting. Jada was having almost daily crying spells. Now in our mornings, she would wake up sobbing. During one stretch, she cried for 45 days straight.
"So, Will, to what do you attribute your meteoric success?"
"Well, I consider myself to be fairly average in talent. Where I believe I excel is in my unflinching, unyielding discipline and work ethic. While the other guy's eating, I'm working. While the other guy's sleeping, I'm working. While the other guy's making love, well, I'm making love too, but I'm working really hard at it." Reporters used to love that response. And while I was joking, the reality of the math was very simple to me. If I could wake up and start an hour earlier than everyone else, and stay an hour later than everyone else, and work through my lunch break, I would be gaining 15 extra hours every week on the competition. That works out to 780 more productive hours in a year than the next guy. That's the equivalent of 1 month. If you give me a 1 month head start on anybody, they'll never catch me. And if they need their weekends and vacations so they can get their beauty rest and recover and maintain their little punk ass work-life balance, then they will always be looking at my taillights. It was Christmas Eve, we had rented a house in Aspen, Colorado. The 2 weeks either side of Christmas were Jada's entire reason for enduring the rest of the year. She had two non-negotiable demands. The whole family had to be there for the whole 2 weeks, and it must be spent where there was snow. We would move around year to year depending on the probability of frozen precipitation. There was no holiday, no celebration, no gathering or event that got anywhere near the emotional value Jada placed on family time at Christmas. Her Christmases as a child had been less than festive, to say the least. And she was going to make up for it with her own family. Note, Cherie has spent every Christmas with us for almost 2 decades. Quincy was right. Everyone had to wear Christmas clothes that Jada picked out, one-piece pajamas with footies, ugly sweaters, reindeer ears, special one-horse open sleigh rides, singing Christmas carols, all mandatory. Black Santa Claus lamps in every room, motion-activated Rudolphs scaring the shit out of you when you just want a Christmas cookie in the middle of the night, and a 40-foot Christmas tree wedged in the corner of our living room looking like Shaq in a Prius. During the year, Jada was Peaches from A Lowdown Dirty Shane, a ghetto superstar. But at the first jingle of sleigh bells, she turned into a Midwest middle-aged white lady. This year, Jada decided that we were going to enjoy a family game of Monopoly. Just for a little context, I am a master Monopoly player. This is not a joke. I'm not saying it to be facetious. This is not hyperbole. I've studied. I have worked with professional instructors. I fully intended to play international Monopoly tournaments. When the dice hit, I don't have to count squares. I know that states is 6 squares to New York. I just pick up the piece and move it. I also know that if you land on go when you have a lot of property, you do not want to roll a 7 because you'll hit chance, and you always know the property assessment card is coming. And you hate that 9 from Kentucky because it throws you back to jail and you have to walk the gauntlet again without collecting your $200. We all sat down and the game began. I found myself in the unenviable Monopoly position of being stuck with Boardwalk and Park Place. Amateurs think that Boardwalk and Park Place are prime real estate. What they don't realize is that they're actually priced out of the range of manageability. The property values increase as you move around the board from go. Boardwalk and Park Place are the most expensive to buy and the most expensive to build. And because there's only 2 of them, you lose a 40% probability of getting hit as other players move around the board. You invest all this money, they take longer to build, so you're hitting other players' properties before you're set up to be hit. And then they skate past them for the whole game. In a nutshell, Boardwalk and Park Place are sucker properties. They force you into a Hail Mary toward the end of the game, praying for a big hit. In this lamentable Monopoly purgatory is where I found myself this night. Willow was 7. She established the first Monopoly, Illinois, the red properties. I have Virginia and States, the purples, Boardwalk and Park Place, and 3 of the railroads, but I'm broke. Jaden is leery of my Monopoly skill set, so he's squeamish about doing deals with me. He's 9. And he's refusing every angle and offer I present to him to get St. Charles from him and complete my purple Monopoly. Jada has the Pacific line. That's the greens, but she doesn't have any cash to build either, so she's no threat. Trey has Baltic and Mediterranean. That's the plum color right next to go. And the full Connecticut line. That's the baby blues. He has an entire block. He's burned most of his cash to get it, but he's the gorilla on the board. Note, having an entire block or a corner is the holy grail of Monopoly. You get hit every single time around the board and by every player. As the houses and hotels begin to come up on the board, the frailty of my Boardwalk and Park Place position is being exposed. The competitive noose is tightening around my neck. The Hail Mary is now or never. Jada lands on Pacific. Yes! I scream, clapping my hands, causing the motion-activated Rudolph to slowly turn and see what that noise was. Pacific was Jada's property, so no one can understand why that was such an exciting moment for me. To the untrained eye, she just landed on her own property. But they are novices, and I am a master. I think I may have also startled Jada with my elation. Why is that so exciting to you? She said. Well, you just landed on Pacific, I said joyfully. I was excited to explain my logic and usher them into my elevated sphere of Monopoly understanding. Pacific is 6 spaces from Park Place and 8 from Boardwalk. Other than 7, 6 and 8 are statistically the most common numbers rolled on a pair of dice. 6 has 5 potential possibilities, 5-1, 4-2, 3-3, 2-4, and 1-5, as does 8, 6-2, 5-3, 4-4, 3-5, and 2-6. When you pick up those dice next time, there's a 13.89% probability that you'll throw a 6, same percentage for an 8, which comes out to nearly a 30% probability that when you throw those dice, you're going to get a 6 or an 8. And when you do, I'm going to have 3 houses on each, and you, young lady, are toast. You can't afford to hit. I busily set to mortgaging all of my properties, 100 each for the railroads, 70 for states, 80 for Virginia, just enough to go from 2 houses to 3 on Boardwalk and Park Place, which in Monopoly is the exponential increase. When you go from 2 to 3, you maximize the return on your investment. Are you sure you want to do that? Jada asked calmly. Hell yeah, I say, my eyes widening with anticipation. I hand Jaden, who's the banker, the $400 necessary to complete my Hail Mary transaction. You are definitely rolling a 6 or an 8. Jada remains steady, not breaking her gaze upon me. So you are sure that you want to put your wife out of the family Monopoly game with your children on Christmas Eve? I finally turn and catch eyes with her. I was totally certain I wanted to do that before she put the emphasis on those key words. Wife, family, children, and Christmas Eve. But now I was down to just mostly certain. If you can't stand the Monopoly heat, you got to stay out the Monopoly kitchen, Jada, I said jokingly. Jada nods her head, slowly palms the dice, shakes them way too many times, clearly trying to give me a chance to change my mind, but I'm dug in. She drops the dice into the center of the board, and the mystical 13.89% probability becomes a 100% stone-cold actuality, 4-2. Jada turns her property into the banker, Jaden, kisses Willow, touches Trey's hair, and heads off to bed. Yes, dear listener, it is obvious today, but I was functioning at the time on a very different operating system. My mindset was, you fight how you train. I felt like Jada and my family needed me to think like that. They needed me to cultivate and maintain a winner's mind. They needed me to never detrain my warrior instincts. I'm a black man in Hollywood. In order to sustain my position, I can't get caught slipping, not even once. I had to be perfect at all times. It took me years to realize that Jada wasn't actually playing Monopoly. She was bonding and connecting and enjoying family time. Apparently, I was the only one who was actually playing Monopoly. I've since upgraded my software and developed a new axiom. Never get caught playing Monopoly. Daddy-O taught me how to play chess when I was 7 years old. In the summers, we would play almost every night. He would set the board up on the back porch and go back and forth between the game and the grill. He would play our next door neighbor, Mr. John, sometimes. He played me no differently. Daddy-O didn't believe in taking it easy on kids. He thought that giving children false wins did a vile disservice to their growth and development, even to their ability to survive in the world. He smashed me, game after game, month after month, checkmate after brutal checkmate, year after year, until I was 13 years old. I will never forget the moment. He had taught me the Joko piano opening. I had faithfully played that opening and response for years. But on my own, I started practicing the Ruy Lopez variation, and he was less familiar with that. The game moved calmly from the opening to the middle game. My position was strong, and Daddy-O knew it. No trips to the grill, no sips of his Chivas Regal. His Tartan 100 burned untouched in his ashtray. Total silence, total attention upon every move. Daddy-O's style was unrelenting attack. Put the pieces down their throat, ram them down their throat, he'd say. But tonight, first, he pulled his bishop backward, then scrambled his knight back to defend his king. It was my move, and I saw it. But he didn't. I was frozen. I sat over the board, my heart pounding, minutes burning away. I couldn't bring myself to make the fatal move. Oh, shit, Daddy-O says. He saw it. Daddy-O looks directly into my eyes. He knows my hesitancy is not because I don't see it. He knows it's because I'm scared to make it. Go ahead, move it, he said. I picked up my knight, setting it gingerly into its final position. The felt on the bottom of the chess piece like a soft guillotine. What's that? He said. I couldn't even bring myself to say the final words. Check? I said. You know goddamn well that ain't no check. What is that? Check. Mate? Why are you putting a question on it? Say it. Checkmate. Yep. Good game. Daddy-O shook my hand, grabbed his cigarette and drink, and went inside. We never played chess again. For years, I thought it was because he was a sore loser. But as I got to understand him better, I saw that he wanted my final memory of playing chess with my father to be perfect. He wanted my mind to be programmed to winning and to savor the victory. His training of me on the chessboard was complete. It was a mythological rite of passage, and he didn't want to tarnish it. Nothing in our world is mine, Jada said. I didn't want to live like this. I wanted a small farm and a quiet life. I get that, I said, but we're here. So how do we fix it? You can do anything, babe. Anything. What do you want to do? Jada had loved metal music all through her teenage years. She has one of the most eclectic ears I've ever known. She'd always dreamed of having a band, but she caught me off guard when she announced she was putting together a heavy metal band. Jada is a brilliant poet and thinker. The depth of her lyrics has always captivated and moved me. I was trying to love and support her, so I was quietly going along with her journey. And then she handed me a book called Women Who Run with the Wolves by Clarissa Pinkola Estes. Jada had marked a story titled La Loba, The Wolf Woman. The sole work of La Loba is the collecting of bones. She collects and preserves, especially that which is in danger of being lost to the world.
When she has assembled an entire skeleton, she raises her arms over it and sings out so deeply that the floor of the desert shakes. And as she sings, the wolf opens its eyes, leaps up, and runs away. The wolf is suddenly transformed into a laughing woman who runs free toward the horizon. A dismantled skeleton that lies under the sand. It is our work to recover the parts, to look for the indestructible life force, the bones. It is a miracle story, a resurrection story. If we sing the song, we can call up the psychic remains of the wild soul and sing her into vital shape again. To breathe soul over the thing that is ailing or in need of restoration, by descending into the deepest mood of great love and feeling, then to speak one's soul. This is singing over the bones. We cannot make the mistake of attempting to elicit this great feeling of love from a lover. For this woman's labor of finding and singing the creation hymn is a solitary work, a work carried out in the desert of the psyche. The idea that La Loba had to sing over the bones to resurrect the dead parts of herself was intensely resonant to me. If you kill one aspect of a woman, you kill the whole woman. La Loba gathers the dismantled skeleton of the shattered feminine and begins to sing it back to life. Jada had killed parts of herself to sustain our family. And her band, Wicked Wisdom, was how Jada would unleash La Loba to resurrect the whole of herself. Jaden used to lay in bed with me when I would read screenplays, deciding which new world I would inhabit next. He loved to hear the stories as much as I loved to tell them to him. He'd stare and watch me as my mind danced, trying the characters on for size. "I can do that, Daddy."
"You can do what, man?"
I said.
"I heard you on the phone with the man earlier."
The man was Gabriele Muccino, an Italian director who had just been hired to make The Pursuit of Happiness. Gabriele didn't speak English. We needed a translator for our initial meeting. The leading directors in Hollywood were being considered for this film, but Gabriele was the top choice. Todd Black, a major Hollywood producer, had sent JL a 2020 piece about a guy named Chris Gardner. Chris had gone from homeless and living with his young son on the streets of San Francisco to becoming a successful stockbroker. The screenplay was stunning. It was a perfect hero's journey. We had our choice of the top directors, but I loved L'Ultimo Bacio, a film that Gabriele had directed, so I asked JL to set up a meeting. I was pretty sure that Gabriele ultimately wouldn't direct the film, but I had long ago learned the power and importance of exploration. General meetings with world-class artists had become standard operating procedure. The meeting was awful. Gabriele didn't want to use the translator. He was trying to speak English, but he didn't speak English. JL and I didn't even try to speak Italian because we don't speak Italian. But Gabriele's artistic passion culminated in two game-changing moves. One, he gave us an Italian film, Vittorio De Sica's The Bicycle Thief, which won the Academy Award for Most Outstanding Foreign Language Film in 1950, and through the translator said, "This is the movie I want to make." And then he got me. He said, "If you don't choose me to direct this film, please don't choose an American filmmaker, because Americans don't understand the beauty of the American dream." Gabriele was in.
"So what makes you think you can do this, man?"
I said to Jaden. Jaden was 6 years old at the time, and other than elaborate home movies, he'd never shown any interest in the business.
The man keeps saying to you that he can't find a little boy to play your son. That's because I'm your son, Daddy.
Well, that's true, man, I said laughing.
But this would be acting, pretending. Pretending to be your son, though, Daddy, duh. I'd be your son every day.
Gabriele Muccino had been struggling to cast the perfect actor to play my son. He'd seen nearly 500 kids. Gabriele is an instinctual, intuitive artist. Things have to feel right for him. Jade and I decided that we would let Jaden audition.
Grazie, 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 Gabriele exclaimed. I wanted a Jaden for this role from the first moment I saw him, but the studio forbade me from asking it to you.
What? Why?
The studio felt that it was a death sentence for the film from a marketing standpoint. They felt that people wouldn't be able to suspend disbelief seeing Jaden and me on camera as father and son. The studio also felt that it would seem like nepotism and just put us in a hole from the first announcement. At Gabriele's pleading, they agreed to allow him to put me and Jaden on camera as a chemistry test. It was such a touchy subject at the studio that Jaden and I removed ourselves from the decision-making process. We allowed Gabriele to run with his vision and cast whoever he wanted. Because we were producers and I was starring, there were conflicts of interest everywhere we looked. So Jaden and I agreed that we would not speak on the subject. We would be parents only. Jaden ultimately was asked to audition an unprecedented 9 separate times. The studio simply didn't want the problems that came along with casting him. But audition after audition, in all of his innocent 6-year-old glory, he proved himself the right actor for the role. After his 9th audition, though, the studio requested a 10th. Jada had had enough. She informed Gabriele and the studio that Jaden was no longer available for the role. At which point, Gabriele, the bleeding, passionate artist that he is, decided that he was emotionally incapable of making the film without Jaden. The studio relented and offered Jaden the role of Christopher Jr. in The Pursuit of Happiness. For me, this was perfection. On the set, at work with my son. That was how I wanted to parent. On the battlefield of life, real stakes, real outcomes, real hunting. I could correct errors in real time, and I could teach in real life scenarios. This is how I defined parental love. Ozfest is a traveling heavy metal festival. Established by Ozzy Osbourne and his wife, Sharon, it began in 1996 and featured all of the metals. Thrash, industrial, hardcore punk, deathcore, metalcore, post-hardcore, alternative, death, gothic, and new. Sharon had seen Jada's band, and some part of her understood. She and Jada became friends, and Sharon put Wicked Wisdom on Ozfest in summer 2005. Ozfest is the least African-American event outside of that broom and big-ass hockey puck thing they do at the Winter Olympics. Babe, are you sure you don't want to, you know, do some R&B? I asked softly, but I meant it hard. This is the music I feel, Jada said softly, but she meant it hard. So we packed up our children and headed down the black brick road to the land of Oz. I had never seen this side of Jada. La Loba was raging. Ozfest is a purist audience, and what began as skepticism and dismissal with every show was transformed first into silence and ultimately into respect. Jada's creative energies were being revived. She was coming up with ideas for TV shows and movies she wanted to write and direct. She was filling journals with poetry and artwork. It was breathtaking to see the bones struggling to reanimate. With every spit, curse, and growl, Jada seemed to come alive. Jada and I had agreed early in our marriage that we would never work at the same time. One of us would always have to be available full time to the children. The Pursuit of Happiness was scheduled to begin principal photography in fall 2005. Jada's appearance at Ozfest was so successful that Guns N' Roses asked her to open for them on their upcoming tour. But the tour was set smack dab, dead center in the middle of Pursuit. At the time, I felt like Jada had options. We had my mom and Gammy, and I was going to be there every step of the way. Jaden and I would be sharing a trailer. All of his scenes were with me. In retrospect, I can see the truth. Jada was faced with a horrific reality, and there was no version of her leaving her 6-year-old son without his mother on his first movie gig. Jada turned down Guns N' Roses. The Pursuit of Happiness came out in 2006 and was a critical success and a box office smash and garnered my second Academy Award nomination. If I felt invincible before, now I really felt it. I just made a movie about a homeless black guy who gets a job in the 80s and still crushed every other movie at the box office that season. I couldn't miss. The streak continued. I Am Legend roared out the first weekend with the largest ever box office gross for a movie in December. It was a movie that featured me on screen alone with a dog, and it grossed around $600 million. Then Hancock, written by Vince Gilligan of Breaking Bad fame, about an alcoholic superhero, came out and grossed another $600 million plus within 6 months of I Am Legend. I was unstoppable. It was the greatest streak of smash hits of any movie actor in Hollywood history. I became the highest grossing film actor ever. And I still wasn't even 40 years old. The problem was, I'd conflated being successful with being loved and being happy. These are three totally separate things. And since I had conflated them, I ended up suffering from an even more insidious version of the subtle sickness, which I can best describe as more, 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 more. If I am more successful, I'll be happier and people will love me more. I was trying to fill an internal emotional hole with external material achievements. Ultimately, this kind of obsession is insatiable. The more you get, the more you want. All the time, never quite scratching the itch. You end up with a mind consumed by what it doesn't have and what it didn't get, and in a spiraling inability to enjoy what it has. I Am Legend had opened to the biggest December opening ever. When JL called to give me the weekend grosses, he was uncharacteristically ecstatic. The 3-day was $77.2 million in 3,600 theaters, JL said. That's over $21,000 per screen. Nobody's ever done that, ever. I was quiet for a moment, and then I recognized a subtle dissatisfaction. Jay, why do you think we missed 80? I asked. What? JL said. I'm saying, do you think it was the ending? I feel like if we had made the adjustment to the final moment, you know, if we could have made it feel more like Gladiator at the end. Are you fucking serious right now? JL said. It's the biggest opening ever. Ever. I get that, Jay. I'm just asking you a question, I said. This is the only time that James Lasseter has ever hung up on me. ever. I'm sitting with Wayne Gretzky and Joe Montana. Their sons, Trevor and Nick, respectively, are on the field with Trey. And over the loudspeaker, the game announcer shouts, "Montana deep to Smith, touchdown!" Trey is a wide receiver on the number one high school football team in Southern California, Oaks Christian. And the son of football legend Joe Montana just threw a touchdown pass to my firstborn. If my life were a movie, I would have looked directly in the camera, broken the fourth wall, and said, "Who wrote this bullshit?" So let me get this straight. You want us to believe that my character grew up bagging ice in West Philly, wins the first Grammy ever given to a rapper, becomes a TV star, and then the biggest movie star in the world, breaking box office records every time he releases a damn movie, marries a beautiful actress, artist, performer, and poet, has three spectacular children, and the greatest hockey player in the history of the sport, Wayne Gretzky, just patted him on the back because his son just caught a touchdown pass from the son of the greatest quarterback in the history of that sport, Joe Montana? That's unrealistic. I'm not filming a word of that bullshit. Get me Aaron Sorkin on the phone. We got to rewrite this crap immediately. And somebody see if Robert Downey Jr. is available. I'm not sure if it's because of my lack of athletic fulfillment in my youth, or the magical energies of the Friday Night Lights, or the surprising development of Trey's physical abilities and talents. But there was nothing in life that I enjoyed more than watching that kid play football. Trey was being courted by the top college scouts. Wayne and Joe were guiding me through the process. As our children were getting older, it seemed like Jada and I used to play a man-to-man defense, but now we were having to switch to a zone. Every kid had something important happening all the time. Just as Trey was preparing for his senior year football season, Jaden was approved by the studio to star in The Karate Kid with Jackie Chan. The family was ecstatic. Then we realized shooting would mean 3 months in Beijing. Trey's games were in Southern California. We all agreed that this movie was an opportunity that Jaden couldn't pass up. We as a family would support him. But the previous year, every family member had been at every single one of Trey's games. And the thought of Trey playing without his family in the stands was unacceptable. During this time, it was becoming clear that the likelihood of Wicked Wisdom returning to the stage was dwindling with every moment of Smith family perfection. But in my mind, there was still a solution for every problem. We would have to grind, we would have to sacrifice, and we would all have to suffer a little bit, but I had the vision, and if everybody followed my lead, we would continue to win, and we would all be happy. We were even winning in the stands. I had Jada to my right and Cherie to my left. We were the picture of the perfect blended family. Nobody could do what we were doing. Not even us. My way of problem solving was to prioritize. I would decide which problems on the list were most pressing and focus on those. But what I missed was that everybody's list was different. Jada, Willow, Jaden, and I left for Beijing in June 2009. Trey went back to school that September. All 10 of Trey's football games would fall during principal photography of The Karate Kid. And then the grace of God revealed itself in the form of the international dateline. Beijing to Los Angeles is a 12-hour flight. A 10 p.m. flight out of Beijing on Friday crossed the dateline, landing in Los Angeles at 10 Friday morning. Just in time to get to the house, get some rest, and make it to Trey's game at 6 Friday night. A 4 p.m. flight on Saturday going the other way arrives in Beijing at 4 a.m. Monday morning, just in time to get back to work. Jaden and I commuted 10 straight weeks, Beijing to Los Angeles and back, never missing a single one of Trey's games. I was loving life. I felt like a master. Oprah Winfrey asked us to come on our show. Me, Jada, Trey, Jaden, and Willow. Even Cherie and her husband, Terrell. An entire episode dedicated to the Smith family perfection. I was the biggest movie star in the world. Karate Kid, Jaden's first feature with him as the star, was about to be the number one movie in the world. The first season of Jada's new show, Hawthorne, had premiered with her in the lead role. Willow had just signed to Roc Nation to record her first album. Trey was the star of his high school football team. And to top it all off, here was my ex-wife talking about how much her and Jada collaborate to raise the kids. I finally had it. My own version of Dallas. The picture was complete and it was perfect. I had built a family empire. This was beyond anything I had ever dreamed. I feel like J.R. Ewing, I said to Jada jokingly. She said, "You know J.R. got shot, right?" Chapter 18, Mutiny. Whip My Hair was a platinum global hit record. Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder were the only artists in history to have a higher ranking single at a younger age than Willow Smith. The record was released 2 weeks before her 10th birthday. Little girls around the world were whipping their hair. The iron was hot and it was time to strike. Jada and I never pressured the kids into show business. Fame and fortune actually made Jada uncomfortable. She felt ambivalent about her kids being celebrities. But part of my vision for her lake was that it would be a creative campus, an artist's haven. I wanted to shorten the distance between anyone having an idea and being able to create art. I built a music studio. There were video cameras and editing bays. There were sketch pads in every room, painting supplies, and pencils everywhere. And eventually, even our living room became the studio for Jada's Red Table Talk. The fact is, the kids simply grew up in it, so there was no pressure. I grew up working in Daddy-O's shop. It struck me as normal that kids do what their parents do. My father sold ice, so I bagged it. Similarly, for Trey, Jaden, and Willow, there was nothing unusual about being on a film set or in a recording studio. It's the family business. It was their normal experience. So no, I did not push my kids into show business because I was an insane, overbearing father. It was only after they decided to be in show business that I became an insane, overbearing father. In the case of Willow, when she was about 8 years old, she got really into singing. This is not unusual for an 8-year-old girl. 8-year-old girls all over the world love to sing and dream about singing on stage. The only difference was that most dads would put her in the church choir or maybe sign her up for a voice lesson or two. I'm not that kind of dad. My mindset at the time was that there is no reason to do anything unless you're prepared to take a shot at being the best on earth. My belief was you should always be aiming at the pinnacle, always striving for the very top of the mountain. Nothing should be done half-heartedly. Willow landed a 30-day European tour opening for Justin Bieber. This was a huge moment for our family. The baby was now throwing her hair into the ring. The frenzy around Whip My Hair was madness. Television appearances, magazine covers, red carpets, orange carpets, photo shoots. She was on Jimmy Fallon, Ellen, blanket coverage across Europe. The entire family flew for Willow's sold-out opening night at the Birmingham National Indoor Arena in the British Midlands. She absolutely smashed. Next up was Dublin, Ireland. Same deal, same set. Once again, she slayed. Another sold-out arena. A synchronized tsunami of ginger tresses. Never before and never since has that much hair been whipped in the Republic of Ireland. The tour continued. Night after night, I watched her grow. Her voice was getting stronger, her stage presence coming alive. She started to learn how to work the crowd. She was able to pop in and out of dance sequences. I felt like a genius. Jada had flown back to LA, so I was on daddy duty. On the last night of the tour, Willow comes off stage in full post-performance bliss and jumps into my arms. "Baby, you ripped," I said. "Thank you, daddy," she squealed. "Was it fun?" "Yes, daddy. I saw all the little girls in the front row and all the way to the top. They knew all the words." "Yes, they did. That's crazy, right?" I said, remembering the feeling in Detroit when the crowd sang Parents back to me. "All right, we're going to go home for a couple of days. Then we're going to start the album." And Justin's team loved what you're doing so much that they want you to do the same thing in Australia. "I'm finished, daddy," she gushed with so much glee that I almost missed what she said. "What'd you say, Bean?" "I said, I'm finished, daddy. I'm ready to go home." "Well, yeah, you're finished for a few days, sweetie, but really, you just started. You have a few more weeks to go," I said in the standard parental, not taking my kids seriously tone. "No, no, daddy, I'm finished." "Yes, for this part, Bean, you made a promise to Mr. Jay-Z that you would do the whole album and more videos." "No, daddy, you made a promise to Mr. Jay-Z," she said, smiling that she scored a point on her daddy. "Honey, we promised together. And when you start something, you have to finish it." "It doesn't matter to you that I'm done, daddy?" Willow said. "Well, of course it matters, baby, but you can't be done." "Why, daddy? I have fun and I'm finished." "I get that, but you can't be finished until you complete what you promised to do." This was such a foreign idea to her. She stared at me with no malice, no anger, just a delicate confusion. And then she relented. "Okay, daddy." We flew home. The Smith family European conquest had been a mega success. I set out busily organizing the next phase, world domination. One morning at her lake, I had just finished a call with Jay-Z when Willow came skipping into the kitchen for breakfast. "Good morning, daddy," Willow said joyfully as she bounced to the refrigerator. My jaw nearly dislocated, dislodged, and shattered on the kitchen floor. My world-dominating, hair-whipping, future global superstar was totally bald. During the night, Willow had shaved her entire head. My mind raced and scrambled. How was she going to whip her hair if she didn't have any? Who the hell wants to pay to watch some kid whip their head back and forth? But before I could respond, I felt something slowly turning, shifting, until it clicked into place. In a moment of divine connection and revelation, she had reached me. I wasn't angry. I was shaken. The feeling you would have if you were absent-mindedly texting on your cell phone and you stepped off the sidewalk into the path of an oncoming bus, and at the last second, somebody snatched you back to safety. Willow was my little catcher in the rye. I leaned down, peered deeply into her eyes, and said, "I got it. I am so sorry. I see you." "Thank you, daddy." And as strange as this may sound, In that moment, I discovered feelings. It doesn't matter to you that I'm done, Daddy. I know it sounds crazy, but Willow's question put a Liberty Bell-sized crack in my worldview. It was just an innocent question from a daughter to her father, but somehow I knew that it was more than that. What she was really asking me was, don't you care how I feel? It was the deepest existential human question. It may be the most important question that we as humans ever ask each other. Does it matter to you how I feel? Even though she was only 10 years old, and my choice to abandon the conquest had sufficiently answered her question in the affirmative, I asked myself, what is my honest answer? I took a deep, hard, self-reflective look at my belief systems around feelings, and my truth startled me. I would have never said this out loud, but a truthful answer to, does it matter to you how I feel, would have sounded something like this. Not exactly, sweetheart. Feelings are seventh on my list. First and foremost, I care that you eat every day. Second, I care that you have somewhere to live. Third, I care that you're safe. Fourth, I care that you are intelligent and your mind is trained to solve the problems of your life. Fifth, I care that you're strong because the world is hard. And sixth, I care that you're productive. I want you to contribute to the human family. And I believe that if you have all of those things, they will add up to you feeling great. I believe that if I take care of 1 through 6, number 7, your feelings will take care of themselves. And this is not something I just apply to you. I don't even care how I feel. Many of my feelings have been enemies to my dreams and to our prosperity. I don't feel like running 5 miles at 5 a.m. I don't feel like working 80 hours a week. I don't feel like getting booed on stage and feces thrown and M80s hurled at my head. And I know that if I worry about how I feel, I won't be able to feed, clothe, house, and protect my family. When I determine a right action for our survival and prosperity, it doesn't matter to me that I don't feel like doing it. If it's obviously an action of supreme benefit, then to hell with my feelings. When people are too worried about how they feel, they'll never feel how they want to feel. Note to any of my horrified listeners, I don't care how you feel. Just kidding. That was a joke. Here's the thing. I watched my father's negative emotions seize control of his ample intellect and cause him over and over again to destroy beautiful parts of our family. I also sat in church one time when Miss Mamie caught the Holy Ghost, and she was so overwhelmed by positive emotion that she leaped from the pew in joyful ecstasy and swung her left hand so wildly that she damn near broke my nose and didn't even notice. While my feelings about feelings have evolved and elevated, I still struggle to this day when extreme emotion arises in myself or others. Feelings are extremely valuable tools for maneuvering and manifesting in the world. They are like fire. They can be used to cook and heat and cleanse. But when extreme emotions go unchecked, my experience has been that they will incinerate your dreams. Unfortunately, at the time, I was neither wise enough nor articulate enough to prevent the many gruesome wildfires that were about to consume my life. Willow's act of protest kicked off a period in our family that I refer to as the mutiny. The pressure had been building for years. I was trying to head it off, but it was all about to unravel. We were sitting in the kitchen, me, Jada, and Willow. Willow was eating dulce de leche ice cream, her left hand playing with my beard, a spoonful of Häagen-Dazs in her right. She said it so sweetly, but sometimes from the mouths of babes. Mommy? Yes, sweetie. It's so sad, Willow said. What is, honey? Daddy has a picture of a family in his mind, and it's not us. I was at the top of the mountain. I was living beyond everything I had ever dreamed. Every goal had been attained, every obstacle conquered, and then some. Yet everybody around me was miserable. Daddy has a picture of a family in his mind, and it's not us. Willow looked me in the eye with so much compassion. She genuinely felt bad for me. Dulce de leche dripping down her arm. Jada mercifully looked away, pretending she'd seen something of critical importance in the lower freezer. Willow just kept rubbing my face. It's okay, Daddy. You'll be okay. To this day, dulce de leche ice cream is forbidden in my house. I started noticing feelings everywhere. I'd be sitting in a business meeting and someone would say, it's nothing personal. It's just business. And I realized, oh shit, there's no such thing as just business. Everything is personal. People get furious, excited, frustrated, hopeful, hopeless, disappointed, fearful, embarrassed, all in the confines of business meetings. Everybody is caught up in their feelings, making all their decisions all the time based only on how they feel. Even my aversion to extreme feelings is based on how I feel about feelings. I felt like Christopher Columbus, who had discovered this new place where people was already at. Sorry about that preposition, my mom. All of politics, all of religion, all of sports, culture, marketing, eating, shopping, sex, everything is centered on how people feel. Then the truth hit me like a 90 mile per hour fastball. Nobody gives a shit about anything except how they feel. Feeling good is the most important thing to everyone, everywhere, at all times. We are choosing our words, actions, and behaviors in order to achieve a feeling that we deem positive. There's nothing more important than feeling how we want to feel. And people determine whether or not you love them by how well they feel you honor their feelings. This has been a precarious conundrum in most of my adult relationships. I've always been less concerned about someone's immediate feelings than I've been about their overall well-being. People in my life have consistently complained about feeling unconsidered by me. And when left unaddressed, this has sometimes festered into feeling unloved. I would walk through fire for the people I love. I am fully prepared to die for my family. But no, I haven't always focused on their feelings. I don't trust feelings. Feelings come and go and change like the weather. You can't plan anything around them. And just because somebody feels something doesn't make it true. Just because your feelings are extreme doesn't mean that you're right. In fact, the more extreme your feelings are, the more likely it is that they're skewed. People care less about facts, truth,
probabilities, or intentions than they do about how they feel and how well you have displayed that you care about those feelings. So when we open sentences with, "The fact of the matter is," the other person is thinking, "I just talked for 10 minutes. I told you what my fact of the matter is." Or if we say, "Look, here's the reality," the other person is thinking, "Asshole, I just told you the reality." Other classic offenders include "truth be told" and "at the end of the day" and "I get it, but in all likelihood" and "I get it, but here's the thing" and "can I be honest?" Use any of those and you're dead in the water. People take it as a total negation of what they just said and a complete disregard of their feelings. Nobody cares what you think and what you feel. They care what they think and what they feel. That's why they said it. There are other inherent questions attached to, "Does it matter to you how I feel?" If the answer is yes, then the next unspoken question is, "How much?" And then, "What behavior alterations are you willing to make to show me how much? And what parts of your personal agenda are you willing to let go of in order to